It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nearly 5 million Pennsylvanians cast votes in last week's election. But now the American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit over some uncounted absentee ballots. Chris Potter is the leader of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability team and has been working this story. Chris, so how many absentee ballots are we talking about here?
So the ACLU in its lawsuit says that in the past decade, about 300,000 absentee ballots were requested by voters but not sent in or not counted by the county on time. To put that in perspective, the ACLU says about 46,000 votes, absentee votes, were not counted for the 2016 presidential election, and that was a race decided by a margin of about 44,000 to 45,000 votes. So we're talking numbers here. They're small. They're on the margins, but elections are decided on the margins, and that's one of the concerns people have.
So this has been an ongoing issue, not just something that happened last week?
Yes, this has been Pennsylvania, and I didn't really realize this myself until I started delving into this this week. Pennsylvania has a hugely restrictive regime when it comes to absentee voting. As people out there may know, you have to have an excuse to vote absentee in the first place. You have to be either sick or you have some sort of religious holiday or you're out of town on work or something like that. So you have to basically provide a doctor's note or the equivalent of that. You have to. A lot of states don't do that. And Pennsylvania has one of the tightest, in fact, the tightest in all the nation, deadlines for returning these ballots. This has been a matter of statutory law for many, many years. It has been an ongoing frustration for people, and the ACLU is now taking this step.
All right. You said the tightest deadline. When do people have to have their absentee ballot returned by?
It has to be into the county elections office the Friday before the election. And to put that in context, the vast majority of states in America, as long as it reaches your elections office by the day of the election, you're good to go. There are a couple of states where that's the Monday, the day before the election has to arrive by. Pennsylvania is the only state in the union where you have to have it in the previous week, 4 days before the rest of us go out and vote.
All right. But is this information readily available to the person who requests that absentee ballot? You must have it in by Friday before.
Sure.
Tuesday.
All that, if you were to go on the website now, though, it tells you very clearly you need to request your ballot by the Tuesday before and you need to have it to the county elections office by the Friday before. It's not a matter of the voter notification. The problem is that sometimes if you request your ballot on that Tuesday before, it takes a day or two for you to get the ballot through the mail, and then it can take a day or two for you to get for your ballot, even if you drop it in the day you get it, to get back to the county elections office. So a lot of people are essentially being disenfranchised just by the time lag here.
Well, Zacy, are you blaming the post office?
Blaming's a strong word. Right. I mean, but one of the allegations in the complaint, and I think we all know this, and I talked to people who said this as well. Mail just moves slower nowadays, and it's not the fault of, you know, this isn't one of like Newman, you know, it's not Newman's fault. It's the fault of
Seinfeld.
Cuts. It's the fault of cuts made to the post office. The post office has undergone some changes where they have to basically fund their pensions thanks to an act taken by Congress. So the post office just isn't moving in quite. It's not functioning as it once did.
So remedy. Can the State Bureau of Elections under the Department of State within Pennsylvania, can they remedy this themselves?
No, this isn't something that could be handled by Governor Wolf or even by your county elections office. These deadlines are spelled out in the state election code. And it basically would take legislation by the legislature to create a better regime. And one of the things the ACLU says is there's no reason not to do it. Periodically in the past, when there have been weather disasters, you know, I think Superstorm Sandy is a case where, you know, remember it wiped out a lot of Philadelphia area. A judge said, you know what, we're going to extend the deadline for absentee ballots in these affected counties because it would be unreasonable to otherwise. And what the ACLU is saying is, hey, let's do this. Let's take that and just say if they could handle it, In that election, we can handle it statewide. Let's have this Friday deadline declared unconstitutional, and we'll come up with a better schedule.
All right. Very briefly. So this absentee ballot deadline, it's the subject of this suit, as we said. But through the years, hasn't Pennsylvania been criticized for other election procedures, whether it's online voting, not allowing it, whether it's early voting, not allowing it?
Yes, actually, I don't think anybody thinks online voting is necessarily a good idea, very susceptible to fraud. But yeah, Pennsylvania is just a tough state. I mentioned before the fact that you have to have an excuse to get an absentee ballot. A lot of states are like that, but some aren't. The fact that you don't have early voting, which would take care of a lot of the absentee needs. If you could vote early, you wouldn't need an absentee ballot in a lot of cases. So yeah, Pennsylvania has a pretty restrictive regimen when it comes to voting. Governor Tom Wolf has spoken about that in the past. That it's something he'd like to change, but there's a lot of resistance to it in Harrisburg, and there are concerns about absentee ballots, the time it takes to count them. They are more susceptible to fraud than in-person voting, so there are concerns. But the ACLU is saying, we've handled it. So many states do this better than we do. We can up our game.
All right, we have just about 30 seconds or so. So what might come from this lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the ACLU is looking for is the Commonwealth Court to declare this deadline unconstitutional, and then kick it into the legislature and say, hey, come up with some better rules. And I think that's really what the ACLU is hoping that happens, that we have a change in law and we don't have to have people having their ballots go uncounted.
And the quick follow-up is there any movement within the legislature saying, hey, you know, we might want to get prepared for this?
Yeah, since the suit just dropped yesterday, you know, it's a little early for people to weigh that. It'll be interesting to see. Generally speaking, there is resistance to changing the rules here in Pennsylvania, especially when in an election context where there's so many concerns about fraud and things are so heated nationwide.
All right. Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Team. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Confluence on WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the AARP, 10,000 Americans hit retirement age every day. That pace of baby boomers turning 65 is expected to continue for another dozen years. But are they financially ready to retire? Roger Ferguson is the CEO of TIAA, the leading provider of financial services in the academic, research, medical, cultural, and governmental fields. He's also the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Roger Ferguson, welcome to The Confluence.
Kevin, thank you very, very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Let's start with, if you don't mind, your overall economic atmosphere evaluation for people retiring now and maybe a few to several years down the line.
Well, I think the overall atmosphere evaluation is that it's really a mixed picture. For a segment of the population, those that are participating, they have saved and have an opportunity for guaranteed income in retirement, I think they're feeling, you know, pretty comfortable. We've done a survey of our own participants, as we call them, and the vast majority of them, more than 75%, are feeling highly confident of their retirement prospects. By comparison, when we look at other workers, only about half of them are feeling a high degree of confidence. And so, you know, there's a bit of a challenge for at least half of the American population.
The Dow Jones hit a high at that point of more than 26,000 in January of this year. And since then, it's been up and down between 24,000 and 26,000. How has that impacted people nearing retirement age?
Well, obviously, it's had an impact on some people near retirement age, if in fact they were, you know, highly exposed to the equity markets. But I think more importantly, the volatility that we've seen in equity markets puts a greater weight on the question of preparing for longevity and, frankly, guaranteeing your income in retirement. What people need to realize is that with increased longevity, they have to manage for longer periods in retirement. Some simple stats today: about half of the 65-year-old men will live beyond 85, and one in three can live to be 90. And for women, if you're 65 today, two-thirds are expected to live to about 85, and half will live to the age 90. And so I think the current volatility in equity markets really tells people they have to be prepared for a long period in retirement.
So the extended lifespan is a nice thing, but the impact on the financial aspect of those years might be another question?
Exactly right. And as we look at the American retirement system, we should be clear that it's very large. About 90 million people are participants in retirement plans. But what we find is in the private sector, you know, only about 48% participate. And so we have the irony of a very large system, but still there's a bit of what we call a, you know, a coverage gap. The other challenges are that there's a gap in the amount of savings, and the third gap is one that we call the guarantee gap. And the savings gap is really focused in on the fact that for all the savings that we have, there's an estimate that we may be short of retirement savings from $4 to $7 trillion with the T dollars. So the challenges are quite clear in terms of more people being covered, greater savings, and then making sure they get guaranteed income in retirement.
I think we've heard about Americans not saving enough for many years now. Are we getting any better at that?
The truth of the matter is that we're not getting much better. A couple of things have happened that are positive. One is since the financial crisis, most households have reduced the amount of debt that they have. It's called deleveraging. You put your finger on the other thing that's been positive, which is that the stock market has been rallying, has been going up in value, and so people's retirement nest eggs are looking, you know, somewhat larger than they did, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago. But in neither case has that really translated into individuals actually saving more of their discretionary income. And so we still have a bit of a savings challenge, even as markets have been strong.
Earlier this year, the Center for Retirement Research issued an annual report indicating that 50% of Americans can retire and maintain their standard of living. First of all, do you concur with that? And even if so, what about the other 50%?
Well, you put your finger on it. You know, it's the other 50% that we should be worried about. And so while we may say that, you know, it's a positive thing that half are in a position to retire and maintain their standard of living, it's the other half that we really should be, you know, focused on and figuring out what we're going to do with that group. So while one may concur, the glass, I would say, is certainly more half empty than half full.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Roger Ferguson. He's CEO of TIAA, the leading provider of financial services. Roger, I think it's accurate to say that you're a bit of a rarity. An African-American is a top leader in the financial world. May I ask, what did it take to get there?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I think getting to the leadership in any organization requires four characteristics. The four that I often talk about. One is one has to have a certain degree of expertise. I don't think you can be, you know, a CEO or a leader even at a smaller level if you don't have a degree of expertise. It could be technical, it could be more organizational, and that comes, I think, through continuous learning. The second characteristic that I think really matters to help one become a leader is you've got to have a vision of where you're going to go. And so certainly at the C-suite level, the question is, well, what's the strategy you're trying to execute, but even at lower levels? And the third element that I often talk about is what I describe as fortitude. People think that careers are, you know, like a career ladder, very straightforward, and the rungs are evenly spaced. In fact, one has to get ready for a career that's much more like a rock climbing wall. You go left, you go right, sometimes you even take a step back, but you have to have sort of the fortitude to keep going. And the last point, it requires that you be able to inspire followers. You have to show empathy and understand that you're working with other people. Those are universal and really don't depend on skin color so much.
Do those characteristics apply in efforts to recruit strong black leadership, whether it's here locally in the Pittsburgh area? And second part of that is, what's necessary to prepare the bench, if you would, the pipeline for future people of color as financial leaders?
Well, let me start the second. And I think what is required to prepare the bench, the pipeline, is a culture that puts weight on both diversity and inclusion. You can't prepare the next generation of diverse leaders in a culture that does not value diversity. And one can value diversity for a number of reasons. One, you may think it's, you know, the morally right thing to do, and certainly I do. But if you're not in the case where you think it's the morally right thing to do, certainly once you recognize that it is a business imperative. We're living in a society that's becoming more diverse, and we're seeing more and more economic data that says that companies that have diversity in the C-suite and otherwise end up having better performance. So I think those are some of the ways that one can go about sort of preparing. And that flips to the question of then how do you retain and attract, and I think it's all exactly the same, which is creating, you know, an environment that is welcoming and open.
Whether it's your current role or previous position that I mentioned earlier as Vice Chair of the Federal Reserve, are you confident that Congress will address the long-term solvency of Social Security?
I think the question when that Congress will address it is one that seems to sort of swing in and out, so to speak. So for many, many years, Social Security was thought to be the third rail. You know, no one wanted to touch it. But the reality is, I think it's inevitable that eventually Congress is going to have to confront this. And the reason is, as you point out, 10,000 folks are getting to retirement age every day. So the cohort of retirement eligible people is just simply getting larger and larger. And one of the things that one observes is problems, challenges of that nature just don't go away by ignoring them. So I do believe Congress will eventually confront the issue. The question is how long does it take before that eventuality becomes a reality?
Roger Ferguson is the CEO of TIAA, leading provider of financial services in the academic, research, medical, cultural, and governmental fields. And he's the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. Roger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up on The Confluence, Amazon chose New York and D.C. to split its East Coast footprint, but we still don't know what city and county leaders promised the company. The state deal alone offered a 25-year grant program worth $4.6 billion. That's in a few minutes on The Confluence. And how could non-users and the medical community better help those struggling with drugs? A panel of experts is here to explain. That's all ahead when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions is created in 1881 in what's now downtown Pittsburgh's Mellon Park. 107 delegates from 8 national unions and 42 local craft unions assembled at the November convention. There, they established resolutions for the new union, including apprenticeship laws, rules against child labor, and factory and workplace regulations. The union's now known as the American Federation of Labor. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh will not be home to Amazon's second headquarters, nor its third. On Tuesday, Amazon announced plans to establish two new locations, Long Island City in Queens, New York, and Crystal City just outside Washington, D.C. 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause reports, while Pittsburgh failed to win Amazon's hearts, officials say it's okay.
More than 200 cities in North America proposed to Amazon that Pittsburgh, an older, mid-sized Rust Belt city, even made it to a 20-city shortlist announced in January is amazing, says Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald.
There's certain things we're not going to be. If you want to be in the nation's capital, that's something that Pittsburgh can't compete with. The nation's largest city with what New York City has to offer, we're not New York City, nor do we want to be.
Competing for Amazon's HQ2 gave Pittsburgh a ton of free publicity, says Fitzgerald, and helped the region identify its strengths and weaknesses. Mayor Bill Peduto agrees.
It's given us also the ability to use the same information to try to bring other companies or to help to build homegrown companies here.
The New York and Virginia headquarters are each expected to see 25,000 new jobs and $2.5 billion in investment. But some groups see Pittsburgh's loss as a win. Chris Sandvig is director of policy for the Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group. He says he's not sure Pittsburgh was ready to absorb the demands that 50,000 new employees, their children, and their commutes would place on the region.
Overall, I think that this could be better for us in the long run. Pittsburgh is very good at putting together lots of organic, small, medium-sized things that become big things and make us very resilient. And something like this would have been a big slug to the system.
Amazon's announcement of its search for a second headquarters kickstarted a nationwide bidding war, waged largely with public dollars. Many Pittsburgh residents have criticized officials' refusal to share the region's proposal. Laura Weens is executive director of Pittsburghers for Public Transit. She says people can take this moment to call for more transparency.
Look, residents should be asked what problems that they need prioritized, and maybe it's housing and transit, maybe it's clean water or education funding or whatever, but certainly above all, they should have the ability to determine where our shared resources should be allocated.
Both Peduto and Fitzgerald say they expect to release the region's bid for Amazon on Thursday. However, Pittsburgh signed non-disclosure agreements with both the state and private property owners. It's not clear how much of that information will be included in a release. The fate of several right-to-know requests moving through the courts is also unclear. Margaret J. Krause, 90.5 WESA News.
Pittsburgh was among the top 20 finalists for Amazon's second headquarters. Responses from the academic community to not being chosen are mixed. Annie Shea is an assistant professor at Carnegie Mellon University's School of Music. She told us that her partner works for Amazon, but they were concerned that if the company moved to Pittsburgh, it would displace people and change the fabric of the city.
For me personally, it's a bit of a relief knowing that the way the city is, the people are, is going to get better by themselves, you know, in their own terms.
Others said Amazon selecting Pittsburgh would have been good for the city's universities. The company had expressed a desire for a city with a tech talent pipeline. Pittsburgh's tech community has had mixed reactions to Pittsburgh's rejection as well. Audrey Russo is the CEO of the Pittsburgh Tech Council. She says it's not surprising the company selected locations near major airports, but she added that Amazon going elsewhere is probably for the best.
Do I think it's wise for one company to come in and have that kind of presence in a city of our size? Probably not. Probably not. And listen, it was a great exercise for the city, for us to get together, to collaborate, to assess what our strengths are, to position ourselves, to talk about our value proposition.
Russo points out, however, that Pittsburgh did get a lot of positive publicity as the result of being one of the HQ2 finalists. Barry Athol is the CEO of Ascender, which operates a startup incubator for several tech companies. Athol says it would have been good overall for Pittsburgh to get Amazon's second headquarters, but he noted that the city's success is not dependent on one industry or one company.
Google is continuing to grow here. Facebook's continuing to grow here. Robotics companies are moving here. We're creating our own new companies with entrepreneurs and startups. Innovation continues to grow. Research continues to grow. We're a thriving economy. One of the strengths of that economy, though, is its diversity.
Athol says Amazon's rejection does create a good opportunity for Pittsburgh to look at its weaknesses and assess its own growth potential. An Allegheny County Court of Common Pleas judge ruled 2 weeks ago that Pittsburgh's bid for Amazon's second headquarters, or HQ2, must be released to the public. Officials had been avoiding that since the process began. County officials plan to review Pittsburgh's proposal to Amazon with media and outline the city and county incentives tomorrow. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The opioid crisis continues to ravage communities throughout southwestern Pennsylvania and beyond. Many treatment facilities advocate the cold turkey approach to kick the addiction. But is that the most effective approach? We're going to address that with Devin Reeves. He is executive director of Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. It's based in Philadelphia. He joins us from there. Welcome, Devin.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Excited to be here.
Sarah Danforth is the Harm Reduction Services Coordinator at Prevention Point Pittsburgh. Dr. Antoine DeWehi is the Senior Academic Director of Addiction Medicine Services for UPMC Western Psychiatric Hospital. And Sarah Bowden is WESA's Health and Science Reporter. Welcome to all of you as well.
Hey, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Antoine, I would like to start with you. What does cold turkey, what does that approach do to a person's body? Is it effective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it refers to the fact that people would end up going through the withdrawal and stop using, you know, like they decide to really just quit and go through the whole process without any sort of a treatment. And in fact, it can be very rough for a lot of people. And most people struggle with that. And this is one of the reasons why people have opioid problems, opioid use disorders. They go back to using because of this, really the sickness that they suffer as a result after they stop using. So which means, you know, it is really can be very painful for a lot of people to go through that whole process of withdrawal. And it's been a contributing factor to people going back to using. So we need to make sure that when we talk about cold turkey, as we're referring to really people stopping on their own too, which we see it. We have a lot of people do recover in a way on their own. A lot of people do stop on their own. Most of the time with people who have opioid use problems, you know, they would have a hard time really doing it without really treatment.
All right. Is it fair to say that there is a growing attitude, an acceptance, whatever word that you want to use, that it is not, might not be the most successful strategy, and that there are other approaches that might be more effective? Devin, let's start with you on that one.
I think the science community has made up its mind that really utilizing medication and evidence-based practice is the best way to not only help somebody recover from a substance use disorder, but also to save their life from an often deadly disease. However, traditionalists, old school thinkers really are attached to an abstinence-only model. Far too many treatment centers are really stuck in the 1980s and the 1970s, and that's just dangerous for young people that are trying to recover from a deadly disease.
Sarah Danforth.
Well, medication-assisted treatment has been proven to be the solution for people with opiate use dependency. And so when we try to advocate any other kind of treatment option, we're not providing the best treatment for the patient. And so it just seems at this point it's past time for us to really emphasize the use of methadone, Suboxone, and Vivitrol as the solutions for people who are trying to end their opiate use.
Yeah, Antoine?
Yeah, we have very effective treatments for opioid use disorders. And unfortunately, the challenge is to get people into treatment, to get people access to the treatment and stay in treatment. You know, and as Sarah mentioned about the medications, you know, that we use, you know, they are a huge part of really the treatment, as well as the psychosocial approaches, which means also getting people into some counseling and getting concerned significant others and family members involved, treatment, and as well as also looking at helping patients who have opioid use disorder and learn different ways to also potentially prevent serious consequences, such as really overdoses, you know, and acquiring, you know, some really illnesses from injecting, you know, and other really behaviors.
Sarah Bowden, from your reporting, what have you been learning about sort of the different approaches or the more acceptance of different approaches?
Well, something that I find really interesting kind of along those lines is that for some people, they may take Suboxone their entire life, and it's not just to help them get through the withdrawal process, but it might be something that they take for decades and decades and decades. And I didn't realize that, but maybe Antoine, you can say a little bit more, but I thought that was really interesting.
Yes. I mean, obviously, you mentioned the Suboxone is one of really the medications that work very well for really opioid use disorders, and it's very effective. And yes, if people have been stabilized and have been doing very well, you know, on the Suboxone treatment, and they are really working the recovery program, you know, yes, people can stay on that medications for as long as they would need to. Obviously, there is a subset of people who choose to, after some point in time, to really, you know, wean off. And there are also other treatment options, you know, like, for example, they could be really, in a sense, wean off, you know, the Suboxone and switch over to the Vivitrol, which is another medication that is an opioid antagonist, you know, and that could be another really option.
So, now, is Vivitrol, like, what's the difference between Suboxone and Vivitrol?
Well, the Suboxone is what we call like a partial agonist. So the way it really works, it really kind of really in a way occupies the receptors in a way that would really still be blocking a little bit, and at the same time, you know, also really have an affinity, you know, obviously to the receptors. The Vivitrol is a full antagonist, which is really, you know, in a sense, blocks totally the opioid receptors. And obviously, the two medications are really effective, you know, and some patients usually would choose to consider the Suboxone, other would consider the Vivitrol. It's not that one is better than the other. I think we always, when we work with patients, we always review with them the different treatment options and let them make that decision, what they believe really would be a, you know, the best fit for them. At the same time, obviously, we can give them our own advice and recommendation, what would work potentially the best for them.
Is it a matter?
I mean, that,
go ahead, Devin.
I was just going to say, I mean, that's part of the problem with the modern day kind of treatment complex is that we're not giving people those options, right? People come into treatment centers and we say to them that this abstinence space is the only way to recover, and they're never given information about medically assisted recovery or pharmacotherapy for substance use disorder. And that's one of the biggest tragedies, and that's why we have to get out there and advocate and educate the general public.
All right. Is it a matter that, you know, of one solution doesn't fit all, and should treatments be designed on an individual basis? But plus, is that a reasonable ask given the cost? Anybody here in the studio?
I think that that a treatment should always be tailored to the person who's taking it, just like any other medication that's being prescribed is tailored to the person who's taking it. We really need to respect each person who is seeking recovery assistance and really try and work with them and see what is the right medication. And that might be trying methadone, seeing if that works, trying Suboxone, seeing if that works. Really just supporting someone along the process, understanding that recovery in whatever form it takes is not a linear path, that it has lots of ups and downs, and just really making sure that the person who's choosing recovery has all of the support along their journey.
That's Sarah Danforth from Prevention Point. Antoine?
And that's an excellent point that Sarah's making, is that it is always individual. It has to be always individualized treatment. Patients have to be a big part of that decision-making. And also sometimes they're considering significant others and family members. They have to be also involved in that decision making. And there are many pathways to recovery. Okay. You know, so we have really a lot of people recover in different ways, and we need to provide them with whatever all the resources they need and let them really choose and decide what would fit them the most and really help them navigate that whole process.
How important is it for the services, in a sense, the contacts to come to the user, to sort of make that step, to take that step?
Well, the depends a lot on their motivation for change. A lot of people are on a continuum of motivation, which means, you know, I can be very highly motivated to change my behaviors and stop using, and sometimes my motivation dips, you know, and I don't want to really change. I think what we would need to do is that we need to meet patients where they are and really walk them through the whole process of mobilizing their motivation. And what I mean by that is that getting them to be more motivated to consider making changes and to really start really basically, obviously, and meeting them where they are. What I mean by that is that giving them also the, you know, the options in a way to how to be able to get more motivated.
So let me follow up. Go ahead, Devin.
Yeah, I think that, you know, meeting people where they're at is not just like a clinical philosophy, but it's also about physical space, right? We can't be in our boxes of treatment centers and saying, come to us, this is where help is. And that's why the work that Prevention Point Pittsburgh does is so important, because they're out in the community, out in the street, engaging people that are using drugs right now, showing them that they care for them. I mean, I don't need to talk about it. We've got Sarah on the line. I think she'd do a much better job.
Well, she's smiling. Go ahead, Sarah Danforth.
We do the best we can to meet people where they're at. We wish we were everywhere in Pittsburgh. We need to be in more locations in Pittsburgh, because there are people who we are unable to reach due to the fact that Pittsburgh has 90 neighborhoods and a whole lot of bridges, and it's public transportation doesn't make it always accessible for people to reach our services. So we help people by making sure they are as healthy as possible if and when they decide to choose recovery. And we also support them on that path to recovery if that's something that they choose to do.
Sarah Bowden.
And I think Devin can also talk a little bit about this, but I know a lot of people in this space are talking about expanding the definition of success. So maybe only using clean needles, or getting to a point where you have stable housing so you can start thinking about changing your relationship to whatever illicit drug or even non-illicit drug like alcohol. A lot of people are using substances because they have lots of other things going on in their life. And so it's kind of what you said, Sarah, about it not being a linear a path to recovery, you know, and meeting people where they're at. Sometimes you, it takes a lot of baby steps, and it's very much a progression.
Devin, briefly, please.
Yeah. The biggest thing is we want to make sure that these kind of interventions, whether we're talking about medically assisted recovery, harm reduction programs, like syringe exchange programs, like Convention Point Pittsburgh, are available in every neighborhood and community, you know, not just in Pittsburgh, but in the suburbs, Westmoreland County, Indiana County, Armstrong County, all across the Commonwealth, because these are evidence-based interventions that have worked for 30 years. And as long as we're in a state that has the most overdose deaths in the country, we can't turn up our nose at any intervention that works.
Antoine, as a medical doctor, I wanted to ask you, has your attitude changed, evolved through the years regarding treatment approaches?
Of course, you know, I've been in the field for more than 20 years now, and I've seen the evolution of the field of addiction and how we have really moved from really non-evidence-based approaches, confrontational approaches, in-your-face approaches, really in a sense punishing people, criminalizing drug problems, to really where we are now basically is humanizing the problem. I think this is a big, big issue here, because we need to treat people who struggle with addictions like people. We treat them as people who are really having a hard time. And we know very well addiction does not happen in a vacuum, and it's multidimensional. And one point that was mentioned about the outreach resources, yes, we want to really go to where people are and really kind of get them to be in treatment and get them really access to the treatment. We have the Center of Excellence that have been sponsored by the state. And right. We have three centers at UPMC. One of them is at Western Psychiatric Hospital. And we have what we call the peer support people who go and reach out to people when they struggle to keep coming back to treatment. And so we want to be more proactive in how we approach patients and treat people as really people are really struggling.
All right. We have just a minute and a half left. Who wants to tackle this one? What about a holistic approach, if you would? You know, medication assisting, but also maybe addressing other medical issues, whether it's food insecurity, whether it is maybe some other chronic illnesses.
I think Devin's a good person to address that.
All right, Devin, go ahead. You got about 30 seconds, sir.
Sure. You know, we look at substance use disorder or the opioid crisis, a really failed drug policy in our country. We say, how do we fix this? And the truth is we need to fix our housing programs. We need to fix our education program. We need to fix the education that our helpers get. What it comes down to is it's not just one problem, the opioid epidemic. It's dozens of problems that need to be unpacked and unpeeled. And until we educate legislators on every level on that fact, we're not going to see the change we need. And we're going to continue to see a 30% increase year after year, like we have the last 4 years in Pennsylvania.
All right, we have 1 minute left. I'd like very briefly from each of you, if possible, how do you measure success? Devin, just a few seconds, please. How
sure.
do you measure success?
Any positive change towards keeping yourself healthier and wellness is success in my mind, not just total abstinence from drugs, because that's a bar too high for people to reach the first day too often.
And Sarah, please, Sarah Danforth from Prevention Point.
Success is getting better access to education and resources.
Well, that was nice. Great.
I could talk a lot longer.
Yeah. Well, you know, one other thing I want to say, that people are not perfect. So which means, you know, what we want to expect from people is what they believe, you know, would be the right thing for them to do. And the way we measure success, any sort of really change they make on any level in any sort of area of their lives. And we should embrace that, and we should keep working with them towards making more and more changes, and not expect them to really kind of, in a sense, be perfect, because we don't expect that for medical conditions. We don't expect somebody somebody who has diabetes to really treat, to manage their diabetes perfectly well and expect them to really kind of do it, you know. And so we should not really expect, you know, that in a sense also from really people who struggle with addiction.
And very quickly, Antoine, and not point to maybe past failures?
Yeah, I would not look at it. And when people, I look at it as struggles and challenges. I do not look at failures. And people learn lessons from struggles they go through. And I know very well from my own experiences is that when people have addictive disorders, you know, if they go back to using, they struggle. And they would need to really learn from it.
Dr. Antoine DeWayhe is Senior Academic Director of Addiction Medicine Services for UPMC Western Psychiatric Hospital. Devin Reeves is Executive Director of Pennsylvania Harm Reduction Coalition. Sarah Danforth is Harm Reduction Services Coordinator at Prevention Point Pittsburgh. And Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence. Today's program engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.